So my observation is that in the United States, every decision in education ultimately is passed upon by an elected official, and that ranges from the smallest school board with only 1,000 students, but it's an elected board of education that will decide policy mm-hmm. and how teachers and principals operate, all the way up to through the state legislature, to the Congress of the United States with its Every Student Succeeds Act, to the President of the United States proposing policy. So the education is a political enterprise in the United States. Is that the case worldwide?
I think that's surely the case in democratic societies. But what's often different is that elected officials will be very careful to take decisions that they know will be overturned by a subsequent administration. What I'm saying is that there will be greater effort placed on finding a consensus that is also rooted in the profession. That there would be many mechanisms where, you know, policymakers would listen, you know, to the voice of professionals. They would, you know, try to find a nonpartisan consensus on important decisions before they make sort of significant changes to reforms. Yeah, you know, every political administration at local, regional, and national levels will give its own color to the kind of changes, but you could still see the kind of long-term threat in those kinds of reforms. And that's actually one of the things that we find very, very important. You know, when you as a teacher know that, you know, these are political decisions that can change, you're unlikely to change behavior because you know, well, you know, that's only time limited. You need to have trust in the coherence of policy, and I think that's something that the northern countries and Nordic countries in Europe are a good example, but also Japan are very, very good in making sure that decisions are professionally rooted and taken on a kind of nonpartisan basis.
Speaking of teaching, and you talk right in your book about the teaching profession and teachers as professionals, in the United States there's a lot of discussion about how do teachers manage and develop and grow their own profession. And yes, we have our teacher unions, but it seems to me it's beyond that. It's about setting the standards. It's about setting the rules for entrance. It's about teacher preparation. Any examples of other nations that where teachers seem to be much more in control of their own profession?
Yeah, you know, a lot of that actually happens at the front line. You can start with professional learning communities. Think about Singapore, a very structured process where teachers, or Japan, where teachers work together to analyze lessons, observe lessons, think about how they can improve instructional practice, sort of space in the school to sort of learn from and with each other. Mentoring is very important for novice teachers to have access to the most experienced teachers, and then school development, kind of inspectorates can play an important role. If you go to some European countries, there's a very strong tradition to bring, you know, outside expertise into schools to guide the process, to actually analyze, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of schools well beyond test scores. I think there's many factors that can help actually to elevate teacher professionalism. Initial teacher training does play a role. I'm not sure the most significant one. Actually, our experience shows it's more the opportunities for continued professional development that really make the difference. What appraisal mechanisms does a system have? What feedback mechanisms does a system have? What mechanisms do teachers have to learn from and with each other?
And are there systems that you observe as doing this particularly well?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Singapore is a great example, also well documented, where this is also matched to career paths. You know, the day you enter school, the system will ask you, your school leader will ask you, what do you want to do in your life? You know, you want to go into instructional development and teaching, you want to go into leadership, you want to go into assessment policies, you want to go into, you know, government role. And from that day onwards, they're going to invest in your career, and you have sort of a clear career path in front of you. Many teachers would start with a bachelor's degree, but they continue study, they continue learning. Most of them will make a master's degree while they are in service. So this is a process of continuous development. One day when you become a principal, which is only one of several career options, you would have prepared yourself for a long time into this. And these are all mechanisms of deprofessionalization. Lesson study in Japan or in Finland, you know, teachers spend a lot of time on, you know, building the learning system, in fact. You know, there's actually the government plays only kind of very modest role in that process. It's mainly teacher-led, professional-led.
Any observations across the world about whether there's any particular whether it matters whether you're a federal system, a state system, or totally local? And I ask that because clearly in the United States, our pendulum swings back and forth a great deal. And I've just, my sense is looking across the world that nations have the systems that work for them. But any observations on a federal role versus a state or a local role, such as we have in the U.S.?
You know, I wouldn't attribute too much importance to that question. You know, your northern neighbor, Canada, is a federal system that is very successful. Actually, I think provinces work really well with each other. You know, they are providing different models of education, but in a way that is very well integrated and collaborative. You have countries like Japan that are more school-led and with a federal kind of ministry. I think what matters a lot is actually the room for discretion at very granular levels, at school levels, where, you know, the U.S. doesn't give its schools as much discretion as you would have in many countries. Now, most of the control is at the local level. But if you're a teacher in a classroom or a school leader in the school, you don't have much discretion on who you hire, how you work, how your kind of instructional system operates. And that will be very different in some of the highest performing education systems where schools really own a lot of those kinds of processes.
So I've heard you make observations before that in the U.S. we talk a lot about local autonomy, but then do not give the schools the actual autonomy that they need to succeed. Could you talk about that balance? Because you have several data points on what systems seem to work best, the relationship between oversight and accountability and local autonomy.
Yeah, you know, in the United States, according to our data, most of the power really rests at the district levels. But if you look at this through the lens of a school, actually, you have a lot less discretion than you would have, you know, in even Japan or Finland or Canada, where schools actually are really the main actors in the education system. Whereas, you know, some of the powers that you have at the districts would also be taken on by state levels in those countries. For example, questions around standards, around curriculum design, about human resource management. So in a way, it's not so much a question of, you know, centralization versus decentralization. It's much more a question of what functions in the education systems are best dealt with at what level of the education systems. And if you contrast the U.S. with many high-performing education systems, you know, giving schools more room to maneuver, I think, is one part of the system. And then at the same time also building at the state or, you know, federal levels, whatever, building enough capacity, systemic capacity for system leadership, really, for questions around curriculum design, for questions around, you know, teacher careers. That's very hard to deal for with a district. You know? The critical mass of a district is often not of the size that you can have those kinds of capacities. And so I think the principle of subsidiarity is really important. You wouldn't want to have anybody doing something that the lower level could do equally well or better. You know? And to build on the complementarity of different levels of governments. And actually, I think Canada is a good example. You know, the federal role is very, very light. In fact, it's only about general HR kind of policies. The provinces take this kind of steering role, design role. Germany would be very similar. And then schools really are basically really in charge of their operation.
Anything else I should be asking you?
You know, overall, what you can say is that workforce qualifications in the U.S. are good by OECD standards. If you look at the total adult population in the workforce, skill levels are generally very high. But the U.S. is also the only industrialized country where the young population moving into the workforce is no longer better skilled than those getting out for retirement. So in a way, I think that is the huge challenge for the United States. Most countries have responded to rapidly rising skill demands by investing massively in improving education. That's not what we see for the United States. Now, there are two answers to this. Now, one is to provide opportunities for people to catch up, you know, to continue learning throughout life, to upgrade their skills and later in life. But that's easy to say, really hard to do. One of the things that we really see is that those who have not, you know, gone through a high-quality initial education are the least likely to take benefit from continued education and training. So much of what you see in terms of, you know, work-based learning in the United States and in other countries too is serving those who are already well educated, where the ones who need that most are getting the least out of this. So that's why I don't think there's any way around for the United States to improve its initial education, to make it greater investments in ensuring that every young person leaves education with a high level of knowledge, skills, attitudes and values. And that is an achievable goal, as we see in the highest performing education system. So the challenge for the United States, yes, for today, you know, workforce qualifications are high, but for tomorrow, the picture is going to look very, very different.
Could you talk a moment about your observations about how well the science, various, where there's consensus around established research in science of learning, how well those principles are being implemented in decision making by both educators and policymakers?
You know, we have, I think, improved our understanding of how learning occurs a lot through neuroscience and brain research and other kinds of methodologies. We have not yet been very good in translating this into effective pedagogies. I give you an example. You know, the only way how you're not going to learn a foreign language is if you teach someone in secondary schooling and high school something on Monday and on Thursday. And the brain doesn't pick up language in those discrete chunks, and it's also harder to learn languages at later ages. If you want to learn languages, you know, do that in early childhood education or primary schooling, or have your sports teacher speaking Spanish rather than teaching students a discrete Spanish lesson. So there's a lot we know about this, but translating this into pedagogical practice, I think, is still a big challenge. You know, we know that anxiety is a big inhibitor of learning. And we see that particularly in subjects like math and science, actually, anxiety plays a big role, actually, as an obstacle for young people to learn. So I think there's a lot that we know, but building that into good instructional practice is still a long way to go.
You talked about implementation. Hong Kong researcher Kai Ming talks about translation, and then he uses the word brokering.
Yeah.
And the need that whatever the culture is to broker those findings so that practitioners, school leaders, teachers, others, find ways to implement them. Any observations on this? It seems to me we're at a vital stage where we, as you say, more and more research has emerged. It's being translated, but translation can often be a book left on a shelf. How we actually put it into play so that students benefit from it is another matter.
I believe in that concept of brokering. I think that's very important. But equally important is to engage educators more in the research itself. If you think about medicine, you know, most of the medical research doesn't get done somewhere in universities, but it gets done by practitioners who run clinical trials, you know, basically are engaged in the science of their discipline. And in education, that's still very remote. And actually, many educators who do not believe that, you know, their practice is going to be transformed by science and research because they are not part of that. That's where countries like Singapore have a big advantage, where a lot of the educational science and research is actually done with involvement of practitioners. So if you want to ensure that, you know, research feeds into better practice, you need to make the practitioners part of the research.
The one other group, if I could get a plug in, one other group I'd include in that and make it a triangle is policymakers.
Absolutely.
Because too often, many times I've observed research in practitioners, or practitioners are interacting, but it doesn't get to the policy level.
Yeah, and there's several reasons for that. I mean, policymakers, you know, aren't interested in answers for today. It's very hard to engage them in answers that have very kind of long-term implications. So longitudinal studies are the gold standard for educational research, but policymakers do not want to know what in 2050 the answer to today's problems will be.
I just want to say, as someone who spent 20 years running for two-year terms,
yes.
I was a very short-term person.
But the other part is, I think the research is often not very sensitive to real policy questions. A lot of educational research is very abstract, very removed from the real problems of teachers in the classroom. So I think we need to strengthen that interface between policy and research, and also research and practice, and to make that a very, very strong triangle. What I'm also impressed, you know, and if you go to a country like Singapore, the Minister for Education meets with the head of the Institute for Teacher Training every couple of weeks to discuss those kinds of issues. The Minister of Education is not going to announce an education reform without having it thoroughly discussed with all of the school leaders. Now, they meet with them regularly. So these kinds of mechanisms, teachers often do internships in the administration. they know what the process of policy design and implementation is. And I think there's a lot we can do to actually create mechanisms. In Finland, you know, if you are a school leader, you spend about two-thirds of your time leading your school, but you spend one-third of your time in the administration. You're actually, the local administration is not made of, you know, administrators, but actually of principals. You know, you are not only a school leader, you're also a system leader. You are in charge of, you know, that's where you meet your colleagues from other schools and build the kind of joint knowledge. I think there's a lot we can do to actually build those kind of complementarities and synergies.
Anything else?
I can't think of anything. I'm sure there are lots of things we could be talking about.
But I think we pretty much...
If I can just cut in,
yes.
I'm sorry. Andreas, your folks are getting a little antsy. I think they want you to wrap up.
So okay, we're wrapped.
Good.